A German Operation Paperclip scientist says the Washington, D.C. UFO flyovers were non-human in origin. The April 8 solar eclipse passes over towns with biblical significance. The Aerospace Corporation sets up a rival space conglomerate to the corporate signatories to the Jupiter Accords. A U.S. military contractor finds anomalous military activity in the Atlantic Ocean, and JP confirms that it's the location of the buried space ark. Tall blonde extraterrestrials tell Miriam Delicato about giant space arcs in previous end times. Why is NASA firing three rockets at the solar eclipse? These stories and more in Exopolitics Today, the Week in Review.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
Welcome to the March 30 edition of Exopolitics Today, the Week in Review. There's been some very interesting developments in terms of exopolitics this week. So I want to start with this tweet that I put out on March 24, and it concerns a three-minute interview clip from 1952 or the early 1950s where an Operation Paperclip scientist, Dr. Walter Riddell, says that the UFOs seen over Washington, D.C. were actually non-human spacecraft. And that's very significant because other German paperclip scientists said that Nazi Germany had help from the people of other worlds in their aerospace projects. So I think it's very interesting that you actually have this top German scientist saying, and he did work with some of the major corporations at the time, and he was saying that, and here you are, was on actually August 1st, 1952, was when the interview occurred, and that's only days after the Washington, D.C. flyover. And he's a very highly credentialed German scientist, and he believes that these were non-human in origin. Now, the interesting thing here is that it's always a debate whether or not the 1952 Washington flyover were actually non-human extraterrestrial spacecraft or were they German craft from Antarctica. And what we know about the 1952 Washington, D.C. flyovers is that they occurred on three successive weekends in July. So I think it's very plausible that you could have both the extraterrestrials and the Germans from Antarctica were sending a message to Washington, D.C., essentially telling them that, look, we are here and you need to respond to us and reach some agreements. And so I think that's exactly what happened. Agreements were reached. And these happened towards the end of the Truman administration, and certainly they happened under President Eisenhower in his administration. So here's I released part one and part two of the ET Cedars, Space Arcs, and the Great Reveal webinar. So that's on YouTube. So you can actually see both of those webinars that, well, that's actually just parts one and two of the one webinar that was held in April of 2022. And so now that's available for free on YouTube. So you can go there and watch it. And it has some very interesting information, I think, about what's coming. You know, in that webinar, what we're talking about nearly 2 years ago now, I was talking about space arcs and what they represent in terms of appearing at the end or at the beginning of civilizations, that they can be used both for seeding new civilizations on planet Earth, which is what the Cedars did, the extraterrestrial Cedars, the 24 civilizations that intergalactic in origin, but work with local civilizations from our galaxy in setting up these great human experiments on different worlds. And Earth, as I've mentioned in the past, according to multiple sources, is the repository of 22 different extraterrestrial genetic experiments. So I'll talk about that. So the seeders used these giant ships to seed a new civilization. So, for example, Atlantis, that was seeded by an Altean space ark that landed. The crew decided to go into stasis chambers and that they would then incarnate amongst the population, and that ark would provide advanced technologies for that civilization to grow. Or the other main use of the space arcs would be at the end of a civilization that is imploding or is facing planetary disaster, in order to wipe the slate clean and to restart. What happens is that these space arcs are used as giant evacuation ships and take people off planet. So that's interesting because today there's more and more sources talking about this, and later in this week in review I'll talk about the Atlantic space arc being located, or at least we have a very good idea of where the Atlantic space arc is located. And there's a new extraterrestrial contactee that is talking about the space arcs being used to rescue peoples from civilizations that are imploding. So I will be talking about that more. Well, here is a truly fascinating event, or this concerns the April 8 solar eclipse. Now, according to a person who put out a TikTok video, that went viral. So this TikTok video, and here's the source, Bryce Giles, he mapped out the pathway of this solar eclipse across America. So the cursor is pointing to the 2017 solar eclipse, the pathway that it took across the United States, and anyone within that bandwidth saw a 100% solar eclipse. Now, if you were outside of that bandwidth, depending on how far you were, you'd maybe only see 90% or 80%, 70%, so forth. So that was the 2017 solar eclipse, and here you have the 2024 solar eclipse that's going to occur on April 8. Now, this individual, Bryce Giles, I mean, he found that the pathway of the solar eclipse, or the shadow, that the shadow cast by the moon, which is directly in front of the sun, that the shadow cast by that is going to pass over these 8 towns or hamlets or locations in the United States called Nineveh. And he points out there's 8 of them: Nineveh, Texas, Nineveh, Missouri, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and so forth. So that in itself is very, very interesting. Now, this article that I tweeted, fact-checked, the April 8, 2024 total solar eclipse will not pass over 8 North American towns named Nineveh. It's trying to debunk this story, but it acknowledges that it does pass over 2 of the towns. So this is a map from the Solar Observatory. Let me take it down because I don't think you're seeing that. Okay, so this is the map from NASA, and what it shows is you have 2 of these towns actually being right over the shadow, or being in the midst of the shadow cast by the solar eclipse. So 2 of the towns called Nineveh, I think that's Ohio and Pennsylvania, are in the pathway of the solar eclipse. And the other 6 kind of relatively close by. So they would, rather than experiencing 100% solar eclipse, they'd experience maybe a 90% or an 80%. But nevertheless, very, very interesting story. And, you know, this has gone viral. Now, what I found very interesting, a couple of things. First, that the locations called Nineveh are really small towns or hamlets, really, rather than cities or large towns. Now, the name Nineveh is associated with the Anunnaki Sumerian goddess Inanna and the demigod Nimrod. So, and that's interesting because Inanna is claimed to be aboard the Nibiru mothership that has returned to our solar system, according to Elena. And interesting, I know Elena is doing her next webinar. I think that's in another week and a half. Her next webinar is going to be on the three great goddesses, and one of them is Inanna. So I think it's significant that this name, Nineveh, is associated with Inanna, because people are very interested or excited by the prospect that the Anunnaki are returned, or that the gods are returning, and people are falling one way or the other. You know, I think that this is a wonderful thing because advanced tech and knowledge is going to be shared again, and others freaking out that, okay, the gods, returning of the gods, these are really demons, and that they're going to try and take over our planet again, that they're the fallen Nephilim, and, you know, run for the hills, and so forth. So this is, I think, the kind of awakening we have to go through as a planet to learn about the history of these different gods or goddesses, what they did, and make decisions, discern what we're going to do. Now, as far as the end times are concerned, you know, people are taking this event as just another sign of the end times. And I think that we are in something like the end times, but rather than it being a precursor to cataclysmic global events, I think it's something that was set up centuries or even thousands of years ago by the deep state, by the black magicians, by those that are part of this kind of fallen angelic group, the call them the Nephilim or whatever, that they are real, and that they can use religion or sow religion with some prophecies that they can then use as a template for manipulating global events. So I think that's something to be kept in mind. And some people will say, well, isn't that the same thing? You know, whether, you know, if you have the deep state, or if you have these fallen angels bringing about events predicted in the Bible 2,000 years ago, bringing those about. I mean, isn't it irrelevant that this is something that the deep state has planned or set up and is trying to bring about, that, you know, whether, regardless of their role in creating these events, that the events actually happen as prophesied. And so, you know, that's a fair point to make. So there you have the kind of like location of the towns that the shadows are passing over, the eclipse shadow. And here's a very interesting comparison, I thought, between the eclipse passage in 2017 and the eclipse passage in 2024. Now, the eclipse passage in 2017 included place names like Jonah, Rapture, Ark, and Nineveh, as I've just discussed. Now, you know, this could all just be coincidence that these solar eclipses are going over these towns in a particular area of the United States, which is known as the Bible Belt, that people in those areas like to name give their towns or their hamlets biblical names, and that this is just coincidence. But it certainly is very interesting that right here in the, if you look at this particular image, you've got the 2017 eclipse, you got the 2024 eclipse going from up here from the right all the way down to the left, right in the middle here, almost where they intersect, not quite, but very close to where they intersect, you have a place called the arc. So that's the arc. So that's, I find that fascinating. I mean, this is, is this just a kind of normal eclipse with no great significance? Or is the fact that it's passing over all of these locations part of this kind of prophetic end times that we are in the midst of? So I think well worth investigating those questions. Okay, so here's a webinar that was just done by David Wilcock. It's good to see him back again and producing online content. I know he's been through a very tough patch. I wish him well in dealing with the very challenges. I think anyone that lives in the mountains of Colorado on their own trying to deal with snow and so forth is a very brave person. So he also commented on the significance of the April 8 solar eclipse, and he believes it's signifying a planetary decision, a planetary transition that starts a series of ascension type events. So, I mean, his webinar, his presentation, his YouTube presentation on this topic, he discusses it as something that heralds these ascension type events where all of a sudden people are going to wake up and have all of these incredible abilities that have been submerged in their kind of subconscious because of the deep state preventing all of that from coming forward. So people will start to spontaneously do things like telekinesis, teleportation. It's already is beginning. And we know that there are individuals that are able to do that. I mean, Jean-Charles Moyen has documented several of his teleportation experiences. And I thought what was very interesting also was that he says that in 2025, the positive extraterrestrials are going to show up and reveal themselves. That, you know, his point is that right now we're going through a dark night of the soul where our planet is dealing with all these tremendous problems. And the governments, the policymakers seem to be unresponsive and are doing everything they can to plunge us into a world war, plunge America into a civil war, do all sorts of things with, let's just say, the things that go into the arm, trying to come up with new iterations of that. Now, he's saying that this is about to end, and that in 2025 we're going to have major transitions through the ascension, and that it's really going to happen. And the positive extraterrestrials show up. Well, you know, that kind of matches what Elena Danan was told about the galactics revealing themselves later in 2024 and into 2025. So I think that is very interesting because in the end of the day, I think that where attention goes, reality flows. So we place our attention on a future where we are awakened, the deep state's power is no more, and we have all of these tremendous kind of abilities. If you focus on that optimistic timeline, then you are going to be part of the manifestation of that. So I think there is something to it. I mean, I know there are some that say, oh, well, that's just hopium. You know, we're heading for disaster and so forth, and I want to be pragmatic and realistic. But I think, we need to acknowledge that, yeah, we can be aware of all of the negative stuff that's going on. But at the end of the day, it's like, you know, where your attention goes, reality flows. If your attention is all on the bad stuff, that's what you're going to manifest. So you can be aware of it, do what you can to address it if you have the ability to do so, but put your attention on the positive stuff, on the ascension stuff, and I really respect David Wilcock doing that. Okay, so here's something that I thought was very, very revealing. This is a whistleblower, Michael Herrera. I don't know if it's correct to call him a whistleblower. Oh, yeah, he was a former military, and he was part of Dr. Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project press conference for 2023. And he described being part of a Marine recon team that was on the, I think it was one of the Indonesian islands, and that he saw a flying saucer-shaped craft being loaded with material that he assumed were weapons, and that they were, and that this craft was being protected by black-clad special operators. And these black-clad special operators, they detained Michael Herrera's group. There were six of them, and there were eight of the black-clad spec ops guys, and they had advanced technologies, advanced weapons at the very least. So Michael Herrera's team kind of like stood down, and they were kind of marched off unceremoniously, insulted and all of those things. But he saw this craft, and he talked about it at the Washington, D.C. press conference and said, that's what he experienced. So it turns out that he went to the ARRO office, that's the All Domain Anomaly Resolution office, and testified about what he experienced. And I assume Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, who was the director at the time, was conducting the interview, or at least was part of the interview. But what's interesting is that in the historical report that was delivered, released to the US Congress, there was no mention of Michael Herrera's testimony. So it's quite clear that insiders or whistleblowers that go to the ARRO office, while it was run by Sean Kirkpatrick, or even now, I mean, there's a new, I believe he's an acting director, Tim Phillips. If you go there and you testify and say, yeah, this is what I saw, and I was in the military and I saw and experienced this, and you do that, you're placed in a category of evidence which has not been validated. In other words, it's not considered to be credible, that there's no empirical evidence supporting your testimony. And so it's treated as something that is not worthy of kind of like presenting to the public and analyzing. Because, I mean, if you have like a dozen or two dozen or whatever it is, 100 eyewitnesses saying that they saw this, I mean, this, and they're eyewitnesses without empirical evidence, I mean, that is compelling evidence in a court of law. I mean, that's how they were able to get the mafia, especially in Italy, because they knew in dealing with organized crime, and I think the people that are behind the suppression of these extraterrestrial technologies and projects, they operate similar to organized crime. In other words, you remove all evidence, that if anyone has evidence, that evidence is gone or the witness is removed. And so this is what I think has happened. But in places like Italy, where they summoned special courts to deal with organized crime, they were able to use witnesses, gave them protection, and they were able to find patterns of what's going on. So I think it's clearly wrong to dismiss or to ridicule or to kind of like make irrelevant these firsthand eyewitness testimonies that are admissible in any court of law. Okay, here's something from Winston Churchill, the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom during World War II. Now, one of the things about Winston Churchill is that he corresponded with Benito Mussolini in the lead-up to World War II, and he was aware of Italy and Germany having these flying saucer programs. Mussolini and Churchill were on friendly terms because Italy and the United Kingdom during the First World War were allies. And during the run-up to the Second World War, Italy was one of the leading aerospace powers. So it's not a surprise that, and we have that case of the 1933 flying saucer crash in a place in Italy up in the Tuscany region, and that Churchill would have been made aware of this, and the Italians were studying it, trying to find out who it belonged to. So, I mean, Mussolini, I'm sure he asked Churchill, he said, well, you know, we found this incredible flying saucer craft, and is it yours? Are you working on this, you know, this kind of technology? And Churchill, you know, probably said, well, no, it's not ours, and, you know, well, tell me about it. And so I think he would have known, and eventually the Italians began working with the Germans, because I think the Italians figured out that the Germans had learned the secrets of these flying saucer technologies. And I have described in one of my books, Antarctica's Hidden History, the subtitle Corporate Foundations of Secret Space Programs, that the Italians learned very early on that Germany in the 1920s had successfully developed the first anti-gravity propulsion systems, and were working on flying saucer technologies, so that craft, either it was German or truly an extraterrestrial craft that had crashed, but the Germans were far ahead of the British and the Americans in mastering this technology. And now what's happened is that Winston Churchill was involved in a cover-up of the UFO phenomenon, and there have been declassified X-files that show that Churchill was genuinely fearful over leaks of documents and news about these spacecraft, these flying saucer craft, or these UFOs, and their connection either to extraterrestrials or to the Germans and the Italians. Okay, so this is an update on the recent effort by the Aerospace Corporation to set up a rival corporate trade bloc in space that's going to rival what is being created by an Earth Alliance working with positive extraterrestrials. Okay, so let's go to the story. And what this story does is that, this is Elena Danan discussing this. Well, let's see. Okay, so this is the update from Elena in Star Nations News. Okay, so she is commenting on something that I had discussed last week, where you have the aerospace company leading an initiative of 30 other aerospace companies for future space activities. So what Elena had done was she had notified me before this story came out. So this is before there was a report about the Aerospace Corporation setting up a kind of diversity and inclusive initiative involving 30 other aerospace companies for future activities, that Elena had been told that there was an attempt by corporations that were outside of the agreements that made up the Jupiter Accord. So there were these agreements in 2021 involving leading space-faring nations, along with major corporations or corporations that were amenable to the rules that were being proposed for the Jupiter Accords. And so you would have companies like SpaceX, Blue Origins, Robert Bigelow's corporation. So these kind of newer aerospace companies were signatories to the Jupiter Accords. But some of these older companies or companies that have a vested interest in the deep state, they were not invited. They were not a party to these agreements that exist between an Earth Alliance of the leading spacefaring nations, corporations, and corporations with the major extraterrestrial organizations. We're talking the Galactic Federation of Worlds, the Ashtar Command, the Council of Six or Seven. Sorry, I can't keep up with how many nations are in or space civilizations are part of that particular council. So, and the Andromeda Council. So they are parties or part of this Earth Alliance, or they have agreements with the Earth Alliance. And those companies that were excluded are setting up a rival program. And that's similar to China. Even though China is apparently part of the leadership, it is also feeling excluded, that it doesn't feel that it has the kind of influence, the leadership that Chinese leaders feel is appropriate to them. So they're setting up their own rival space program outside of the Jupiter Accords. So this initiative involving the aerospace company is very interesting because, as I mentioned last week, they were involved in a monitoring and surveillance program of Elena Danan, as well as trying to tarnish her reputation. So I thought that this was very significant, that you actually have this one company involved in setting up a parallel corporate space venture involving up to 30 other aerospace companies, that they're doing this as a rival to this Earth Alliance initiative involving multiple spacefaring nations and corporations in building something called the Hub, like a what will become in the future a major interstellar trading outpost. And so the aerospace corporation, like China, feel in some way excluded from the running of the Hub, and they're trying to set up their own separate initiatives. Okay, so here we have investigative reporter Ross Coulthart, an Australian who 15 years ago in 2009 talked about a triangle-shaped UFO sighting in Gosford, England. And so talked about that at length and did what I thought was a very good story about the significance of these triangle-shaped craft and how they'd been seen by credible people. And so it was something worth exploring. But this is what I found very strange about his report. And it kind of points to a deeper problem with a lot of UFO researchers who maybe more, let's just say, want to focus on validated or well-placed sources or well-regarded sources. Now, there was an individual whistleblower, Edgar Fouché, who did work at Nellis Air Force Base. And he, along with five of his colleagues, wrote a book called The Rapture. And, he wrote the book called The Rapture, where he incorporated the testimony of five colleagues who worked with him at Area 51. Now, Edgar Fouché himself, I mean, he was and is a electronic specialist, electronic weapons. He specialized in that. He's an electrical engineer, and he supplied documents showing that he did work at Area 51 and that he, in interviewing or talking with these five other workers who all wanted to remain anonymous, they didn't want to come out and reveal themselves. And the agreement he had with the people running these programs was that, well, if you just talk about anything happening here, as long as it's not something you've directly experienced, but it's all based on others' testimony, then we'll let it slide. That it's like it can be regarded as hearsay because he heard it from five other sources that he can't name. But nevertheless, I mean, this is something that investigative journalists do all the time. They always cite anonymous sources, and they investigative journalists will have an anonymous source that will tell them certain things. So Edgar Fouché was told these things about a TR-3B that was operational at Area 51 in the late 1980s. And in 1998, he gave a lecture, very comprehensive lecture, I believe it was at the International UFO Congress. And he said that these TR-3Bs were based out of Area 51, and also out of an area in northern the United Kingdom, like in Scotland. And so these things were flying around, TR-3Bs. And I find it very interesting that Ross Coulthart didn't mention that. Now, this could be symptomatic of a deeper problem, that there is this kind of push, you know, what I've called a limited hangout, which is to say, well, you know, there are all these UFOs out there doing this, doing that, harassing military bases, or kind of like appearing nearby Navy aircraft or over nuclear sites. And we don't know what they are, but you know, they represent a national security threat. Well, I mean, that's true to an extent. But if you know or you suspect that some of these craft could in fact be reverse engineered craft that other credible people have been talking about, then I think that what you're putting out could be regarded as a limited hangout. So you actually have Edgar Fouché revealing these TR-3Bs. I have JP, a witness who's serving in the US Army that I've worked with for 15 years now, 16 years actually, that he's been taken on these TR-3Bs or smaller versions of these TR-3Bs. He's been taken on them and he's taken photos. He's got photos of them near major military bases like MacDill Air Force Base, home of US Special Operations Command. And so I think that when there are references to these secretive to these craft, like these triangle-shaped craft, if someone's an investigative journalist, I think there needs to be at least an acknowledgement that there are sources. Maybe you don't regard them as credible. Fair enough. We can understand that. But still, I mean, in terms of like doing a competent job, you need to refer to those and not just ignore them. Okay, so here's something that I've thought was very, very interesting. So I've had this military contractor, and he works for a military service, but I don't want to say anything more about him because he wants to remain anonymous. So he uses the pseudonym Ruetso Zamrico. And so he's been tracking ship and aircraft activity in the Atlantic Ocean ever since I started to talk about the Atlantic space arc that JP had revealed to me. So that, I think, was in 2022. JP started to talk about the Atlantic space arc, and he's been on 6 missions to Atlantic space arc. And initially it was located in the Bermuda Triangle area, and Ruetso was trying to track military activity in there to see whether or not there was any particular area in the Bermuda Triangle that matched what JP was saying. And so, you know, so we talked about that. He shared some data about that. Now, around, I think, after the 4th or 5th mission, JP said that the arc had moved deeper into the Atlantic Ocean and described, you know, why it was taken there, that it was decided that this would be become a more of an international effort rather than a US-dominated effort if the Atlantic Space Arc was kind of outside of the purview of the Bermuda Triangle, which, interestingly, comes under the authority of US Northern Command. But if it was deeper in the Atlantic, then it would be in international waters. And as far as the US combatant commands are concerned, I don't think the middle of the Atlantic corresponds to any particular command. Any particular geographic command. It's very interesting. I mean, because the Earth is divided into different regions, and there is a significance as to why you have one particular military command like NORAD having jurisdiction over North America up to a certain area of its territorial waters, which might include the Bermuda Triangle, and then you have this area outside of that. So I need to kind of find out which of the US commands, maybe it's the European command, that actually has jurisdiction over the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. But nevertheless, according to JP, the ARC had been moved there by Nordics, who had taken it over, and that it was moved to a location that we don't, that wasn't, JP wasn't able to give me, even though he says he knows it. So this is the message from Ruetso, and he wrote to me on March 20 and he sent me two images, and he said, "Heads up, we have the first sighting of a group of military ships in the watch area for your situational awareness. This is in the area I estimated to where the ship moved northeast and looks to be a direction in which all the aircraft that are broken tracks seem to be going. I asked JP." Okay, so these are the two images he sent me on March 22nd. Okay, so you can see that. And you can see this area, he tracked anomalous military activity in this area. So you can see it's kind of more towards the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. The Bermuda Triangle is kind of more over here, more in this area. I think it's in this area over here. So this area, he tracked anomalous military activity. So this is a more of a close up of these craft that are anomalous. That there's no reason for why these military craft are out there. We're talking Navy ships and so forth. And so he's using some kind of monitoring or tracking technologies for tracking ships and so forth. And so these two images he sent me give the location of areas where there seems to be very strange military activity, which could be where the Space Ark is buried, because JP has described the Space Ark is located at the bottom of the ocean, and what typically what was happening was that there would be a US Navy ship that he described as a kind of donut-shaped, circular ring-shaped ship that would be directly over the Space Ark. There would be an elevator going from the center of that craft to the Space Ark. And often there were other Navy ships around, and not necessarily from the US Navy, but they could be from any other country. So I showed Ruetso's image with JP, and I showed it to JP and asked him, you know, is this where the Ark is presently located? And he replied, totally. So he's corroborating that this is the approximate area where the Atlantic Space Ark is buried. Now, I also shared this with Elena Dunham, and when I shared it, she pointed out that in 2023 at the Galactic Spiritual Informers Connection Conference in Orlando, that she had provided a map of where ancient Atlantis was located, according to what she was told by the Galactic Federation and her own memories. So she came up with this map where you can actually see Atlantis there in that portion of the Atlantic Ocean, approximately where the Space Ark is buried. And so here you have images on the red, in red where you have the Stargate and spaceport, of the Atlantean space port. You have Atlas City, so that was the capital city of Atlantis, and you have generators, these incredible generators that were pyramid shapes that would generate the kind of electrical energy or the free energy that was used to power Atlantean ships and to power their cities and so forth. So she sent that, and it was pretty close to, well, actually overlapped that area that Ruetso had pointed out to me. And so what JP did was that he actually came up with a overlay. So you can see this overlay here where you have Elena Danan's presentation of the Atlantean spaceport and generators with the location that JP says, sorry, that the location that Ruetso pointed out, that there's anomalous military activity, naval activity, and what JP said is where the space arc is buried. It's an exact match. So I think we have found the Atlantic space arc, and it was moved to this location by the Nordics for a reason, and perhaps this is a key part of that reason. So that's a fantastic development, because it means now that people that want to investigate JP's information have a means of identifying a geographic location, which is a major part of his revelations, and like look at Google Maps or track anomalous military or aviation activity in that area. Now, here's a story. Giant infrastructure projects are planned to begin on the moon as part of a 10-year DARPA run. That's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is kind of like the advanced technology research unit or program within the Pentagon. And this 10-year project is called Lunar Architecture Capability Study. So this project is giving contracts to companies such as Northrop Grumman to build things such as a lunar railway. So the idea is that, well, with the Artemis Accords, it's now going to be possible for colonies to be established on the moon, and these colonies are going to have a very strong element tied in with corporations that are wanting to mine the moon of precious resources. And so in order to be able to mine those resources, you need to have some infrastructure in place, like a railway on the surface of the moon. So if you are out there and you're mining whatever it is, helium-3 or something that is found on the moon in abundance, and you want to take that to Earth because it's going to be something that's very profitable for your company, you're going to need infrastructure to do so. So DARPA is awarding contracts to companies like Northrop Grumman so that they can build the first lunar railway over the next 10 years. So, yeah, this is a very significant development because it shows that the plans are in place for the colonization of the moon under the Artemis Accords. And that's just using the kind of like reusable rocket technologies that Elon Musk has pioneered. So, you know, even if you kept secret, if you continue to keep secret all of the anti-gravity technologies, the torsion field physics technologies that have been used and developed in secret space programs, even if you continue to use rocket propulsion systems such as used by SpaceX, you could still move forward with this 10-year DARPA project. It would be, you know, compared to using anti-gravity technology, of course, it would take much longer, much slower using antiquated technologies, but still it could be done. And the fact that they're doing this means that I think what we have here is a means of being able to release to the general public some of the advanced technologies that have been developed on the moon. And we're talking about, say, underground technologies that have been developed there. We're talking about very large underground bases, very large power generators there, means of being able to extract precious resources from the moon, that some of those technologies or some of that infrastructure can be plausibly claimed to be like, oh, well, this is what happened once DARPA awarded this contract and Northrop Grumman came along and they built this lunar railway there, but this is the location. But in reality, that lunar railway could have been built a long time ago by others, but it's going to be, and I think this is the way in which right now you could plausibly disclose the existence of giant infrastructure or all this infrastructure on the moon without disclosing the existence of these secret space programs. So I think that's probably what the plan has been, to kind of like do this using conventional rocket propulsion technologies with the possibility that at some point you could just unveil these advanced technologies and you could, or these advanced infrastructure projects on the moon that have been there a long time, and do so saying, well, we just recently built this. Or maybe it would be part of a more genuine disclosure that is part of humanity learning the truth, the full truth. Okay, so my video, The Crypto Terrestrials, Ancient Guardians of Earth's Secrets, I did that on March 23rd on Crowdcast. And Crowdcast is a very interesting platform to do webinars on. People that have worked it out really enjoy it, and I think it's got some great features, that it's got instant replay. You know, when I used to do the webinars on Zoom, you would have to wait a day for the replay, or the announcement would come after a day because Zoom had a clunky way of communicating with registrants. Whereas with Crowdcast, it gives you that capability of doing it immediately. The replays are available immediately, and it also allows you to kind of prioritize questions. And what I find very good with the Crowdcast version is that if you're interested in a particular question, you can find that question in the Crowdcast replay and click it, and it'll take you right to where that question is asked and my answer to that question. So that's great. But not everyone likes Crowdcast. Not everyone has been able to figure Crowdcast out. So what we do after each webinar is also to make a version available on Vimeo. So it's slightly cheaper, but it doesn't have the Q&A in there. So that is now available on Vimeo. So you can go to Vimeo and watch that if you're interested in learning about the crypto terrestrials and their history. I think it's a fascinating history. I think we need to learn about the crypto terrestrials, that they have a lot of knowledge. They've had a lot of experiences with many different extraterrestrial civilizations visiting and interacting with our planet. And, you know, we need to get as much information as possible from all the sources that are relevant. And these crypto terrestrials, like it or not, are indigenous to the Earth. They've been here even longer than the human presence. So we do need to learn about them. So here's an interview I did with Miriam Delicado. I first learned about Miriam back around 2008, 2009. She did some interviews and then she went silent. She went quiet. And that was because she had some difficulties, was involved in a succession of car crashes that were very suspicious. And I'll talk about that at another time. But here, in this particular interview with Miriam, this is the first, and I do plan to do follow-up interviews where we'll talk about other things. She talks about her contact experiences with this group of tall blonde extraterrestrials that are regarded as kind of like the founders or the progenitors, that they were the ones that seeded humanity or played a role in the seeding of humanity on Earth, how they would also provide sanctuary to different civilizations, especially indigenous peoples, at the end of these different ages. So she talked about the end of the first world, the second world, the third world, and we are presently in the fourth world according to Native American traditions. And at the transition from each of those worlds, you had these giant space arcs appearing, and that they carried many thousands or millions of people, hundreds of thousands of people, off planet to sanctuary. Or they could have taken them into the inner Earth, or they could have taken them to the bottom of the oceans. So all possible, those were three possible destinations that these space arc rescued involved. So I found that very interesting, that Miriam was told back in 1988, when she had these contact experiences with the tall blondes, that these space arcs were being used historically to evacuate people at the end of the different worlds. So that kind of matches what JP has been told. Other things that I found fascinating in the interview with her was how there was a Russian psychic program that goes all the way back to the Second World War, and that they have developed a community, I think it was 10,000 psychics operating in the Soviet Union, but now operating in the Russian Federation, and that they wanted to recruit her because they recognized that she had natural psychic abilities, but she had been warned by her father not to join, that if there was an attempt by Russians to recruit her, and she's in a Canadian, that if they tried to recruit her, that she should decline, because otherwise they would never let her go. Okay, so here is the final tweet that I wanted to comment on, and this is a very strange story in Forbes that NASA is firing three rockets at the solar eclipse. Now, why in the world would NASA be doing that? Why is NASA firing three rockets at the solar eclipse? So this is apparently, according to Forbes, and that's a mainstream news source. So the reporter Jamie Carter is a senior contributor. And he is talking about this NASA effort to fire three sounding rockets. And NASA is going to fire three sounding rockets into the moon's shadow on Monday, April 8th. So just over, it's approximately, 9 days from today, from Saturday, March 29. March 30. So March 30 with 7 days to the solar eclipse, NASA's firing three sounding rockets. So why is that? So, you know, this article gives a couple of reasons. So the first two reasons are to measure the drop in sunlight. So the Forbes article says, okay, this is just a NASA experiment. They just want to see the effects in terms of the drop in sunlight in meteorological processes. So, you know, so nothing, a very mundane reason. They also talk about invoking the serpent deity Apep, who is the nemesis of the sun god Ra. So that's interesting. So Apep, I think that's short for Apophis. Apophis, nemesis to the sun god Ra, serpent deity. And so this is, the article, Forbes article mentions this, that this is a serpent deity that is known to exist. So could these three rockets be part of an occult ceremony to invoke this serpent deity Apophis, nemesis of the sun god Ra? And we do know that there's a comet called Apophis, which presumably is going to pass close to the Earth, if not collide with it. I think it was a decade or so in the future. Not sure of the exact date of Apophis arriving. So, yeah, very interesting, an occult ceremony. Or three, and this is what I think may in fact really be going on, to create confusion over what is about to be revealed in the sky during the eclipse. So that during the eclipse, the sun is blocked. The sun's light is blocked for that narrow band. And I discussed it earlier. It's a narrow band of a couple of hundred miles or 350 kilometers. And then nearer to that or close to that band, you might get 90% eclipse. That people during that solar eclipse will be able to see things in the night, things in the daylight sky that normally you wouldn't see during daylight. So could it be that these three rockets are being sent up there because NASA knows or the elite know that there are these giant motherships up there, that these Cedar ships are up there, and that during daylight hours they could be in that, they are operating in that region of the Earth that is during daylight, we can't see the daylight sky, so you can have these giant motherships there monitoring the Earth. But during an eclipse where for, I think it's what, 5 minutes, 8 minutes, whatever the length of the eclipse is, the sun is occulted by the moon, and all of a sudden you can see areas of space that you wouldn't normally see during daylight. So for that 8 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever it is, we'll be able to see things in the sky that normally we wouldn't see. So are we going to see the motherships? So could this be why they're sending up the rockets? To create plausible deniability so that people say, oh yeah, look, I saw the mothership. You know, NASA can say, oh no, that you just confused that with these sounding rockets we sent up there to measure the, you know, the drop in light during the solar eclipse. So plausible deniability. So anyway, so that's what I think is maybe happening, that this could be because the solar eclipse, you might see something up there that normally you wouldn't see. So we'll find out. We just have to wait 9 days and we will find out for that. So that's the end of the Week in Review for Saturday, March 30. If you want to get any sources that I discussed, just go to my Twitter feed, which is twitter.com/Michael Sala, all one word. So that's it. So don't forget to like and to subscribe and share this video with others. I really appreciate that. So I look forward to coming back next week and giving you the next roundup of the Exopolitics Today, the Week in Review.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.